Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. If you look at the great Buddha on the altar here, he or she represents the great Dharmakaya, the cosmic Buddha, which is the pure meditation that is universal and pervades all places, all times, and all beings. The smaller Buddha shows Shakyamuni Buddha, and Shakyamuni represents the Buddha of this world, and in another way shows the Buddha nature in each of us that comes forth from the cosmic Buddha at the time of our birth. Now, most living things, when we are born, think that there's a duality there. There's the great universal cosmic Buddha, and then there's the Buddha nature. And so we see the Buddha nature as something separate. And the reason that we see it as separate is because of our karma, or, you know, which is really the karmic inheritance that we are born with. Now, that sense of separation is so pervasive in us that it is not just kind of a notion that we have that we're separate, but it's something that is in every part of our blood and bones. So it's not something that we can just change our opinions about and then be done with it. Because we have the Buddha nature, because every living thing has the Buddha nature, what that means is that every one of us from the beginning knows intuitively how to meditate. And yet it is something that we either forget as we grow up, or we learn not to recognize the value of it. When you come back to meditation, I like to say that the development and growth of training comes from the inside out and from the outside in. The inside out is that longing we have to better ourselves, to do something about ourselves, or to find something that gives purpose to our life. As we follow that and learn the formal practice of meditation and the working of the precepts, we develop a, I guess what you could call a discipline. And that's the work of training that works from the outside in. As we practice meditation, we learn to bring forth this sense we have of the Buddha nature, or that natural sense of meditation. So meditation isn't something that we are imposing on ourselves. It's something that grows from the inside out. And while we can focus on discipline and on the efforts we put into our training in a retreat like this, what grows from the inside out is not something that we either can or should try to control. It's enough to plant the seed and let it grow. And the way we water it is by our daily practice. Now, as you get into a practice of meditation, you will begin to open up. And as you open up, you will become more aware of that sense of separation, or that sense of longing for unity with the cosmic Buddha. And what that means is that you will be disturbed by the truth. That's the arising of the koan. And that's what I want to talk about this morning, is the nature of the koan. And I want to look at it in terms of the scroll here of that shows the six worlds. I think that you've gotten some handouts that I've shown the basic cycle of the six worlds as a cycle or cycles of unsettledness. If you look at the image of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva in the shrine here, you'll see that there is an unsettled sea at the bottom of the picture. And that represents the sea of suffering or the sea of birth and death. The Sanskrit name for birth and death is samsara. So this here also is a picture of samsara, the wheel of samsara. There's one picture here and there's one there. And I hope that the handouts that I've given you will give you an idea of what's going on in them, if you want to come up and look at them and get a sense of them. I am not the expert when it comes to all the details in these two scrolls, but I do want to point out three of the main circles that both of these pictures show. First of all, if you look at them, this one tends to turn counterclockwise. If you look at that one, it tends to turn clockwise. It's still showing the same thing, and for the sake of talking about these two scrolls, I would say it's like when you look at a wheel on a garden cart. You look at it from one side, it's turning clockwise. You're on the other side of the garden cart, it looks like it's turning counterclockwise. But the wheel's turning in the same way. Sometimes we speak of the turning in a clockwise direction as turning towards the heart of compassion. But for the sake of this talk, I'm just looking, you know, it doesn't matter whether it looks like it's going clockwise or counterclockwise. In this figure, you have a rather fierce-looking being holding up the wheel. And that is said to be King Yama, or the judge of the dead. In fact, when you meditate deeply, what this shows is a mirror, and the intent of it is to show you what you are, and particularly to show you what there is of your past that needs to be cleaned up in order to reunite with the cosmic Buddha. In that sense, the Yama isn't really a judge so much as just saying what Dogen says in the Shushogi, don't look outside of birth and death to find nirvana. Don't try to go beyond the great round mirror. Three circles here. I'd say the main focus of it is this center circle called the Circle of the Six Worlds. Outside of that, running around the outside of the wheel, is the are pictures depicting the cycle of dependent origination. And at the center of the circle is a carcass snake and a pig representing greed, hate, and delusion. When we come to the confession ceremony, we speak of all our actions of greed, hate, and delusion from the far past. So this whole cycle, or this whole circle, represents all the ways that we can get involved in greed, hate, and delusion. This is really a picture of the world of suffering before we find our still center. At the top of the picture, we'll start with the human world. And this picture here just shows various human activities. And if you think of it as looking in a mirror, it's showing you what your life would be like, things that you remember, pleasant or painful, things that you would do differently at another time. We say that the human world is the highest life, and perhaps that's another way of saying, since you're human, that's a good place to start. I think it's also the case, as the human life is short enough, that we know, we recognize the transiency of it. And we can also see within this human life aspects of all the other worlds. Some of the other worlds are perhaps extreme enough that either the pleasure or the suffering in them is such that the possibility of training doesn't really occur to most beings in those worlds. Another reason why human world being the highest life means that this is where you have the greatest opportunity to turn the stream of compassion within. The endeavor of the human world is towards making an effort at leading a responsible life. And it's natural that the merit of that should carry you into what are called the celestial worlds here. At the time of death, it's fairly normal for a person to be reborn in the heavens if they have led a normal human life that hasn't gone to great extremes. The celestial worlds or the heavens in some way are the sphere of delusion because they're pleasant enough that you want to stay there and don't realize that it's one of the changeable worlds. Really, this whole wheel, you could say, represents the opposites. And we often think of the opposites as being poles, you know, like goals on a football field or something. In fact, they're a cycle. And so this is showing the movement of the cycle of the opposites. The koan isn't black and white. The image of the koan that we often use is of a fish that's biting down on a red-hot iron ball that it can neither swallow or spit out. That's an extreme version of it, when in fact the koan that we encounter in our daily life has many shades to it, many colors. It can be something as simple as distracted thoughts during meditation or sore knees or something like that. It can be rubbing up against someone and being a bit irritated. It can be a fish biting an iron ball. But most of the time for us is that koan that arises every day that is both a disturbing and a blessing because it reminds us to come back to being still inside. As the heavens change, as they naturally will, and begin to deteriorate, you move into the world of the Asuras, which are the power-seeking gods, if you will. In this particular picture, they're shown as being part of the heavenly world, the part where it begins to deteriorate. And that picture over there, it's actually shown as being a separate world. But remember that this is all phases of a cycle. So there aren't clear delineations between them. The Asuras are often angry, ambitious, trying to storm heaven, and the pictures show a battle where the celestial soldiers are trying to keep the Asuras out of heaven and the Asuras are trying to attack and get back in. Because of that force of ambition, as the world of the Asuras changes and the merit of the celestial realm wears out, the Asuras move into the animal world, where you tend to act on your more visceral emotions, whether it's sexual desire or anger or fear, fight and flight, that kind of thing. Sometimes the animals are the aggressors, sometimes they are the ones who are pursued. Sometimes they're hunted. I'm inclined to say that even the most well cared for animals don't have a particularly enviable life most of the time. You know, their pets have their owners go off to work and have to fend for themselves, things like that. And in most cases, their lives are short. The progression in the cycle from the animal world is into what is called the hells. And of course, in Buddhism, hells are not permanent. They can last a long time, but they are not permanent. And the feature, the distinct feature of the hells is that one thinks that one's situation is impossible and tends to look down and think that there's nothing that you can do about yourself. So the hells are that kind of abject misery where, for whatever reason, you get the consequences of your past actions and either don't know what to do about them or are unwilling to do anything about them. The karma of the hells wears out, and the misery lessens, and you move into the world of the hungry ghosts. In a way, you could think of that as something of an extension of the hells, where the overruling passion is fear and greed. Longing for something, thirsting for something. But when you find what you think will satisfy that thirst, it makes you more thirsty. And then as you move out of that, back into the realm of human action, where you do responsibly work on yourself, you're back to here. Here we are. The cycle of dependent origination is another way of looking at this cycle of the koan of the opposites, and that's what runs around the outside. I'm not going to go into that in detail, although on that sheet of the cycles of unsettledness, it lists the 12 steps. The important thing is that the cycle begins with ignorance, which can be quite subtle. That ignorance is that sense of not realizing that you are at one with the cosmic Buddha. It's subtle. It's something that, as humans, we inherit from our past. Simply a kind of karmic unawareness. And acting on that unawareness, we tend to look outwards for the solution to our longing to be at one with the eternal. The cycle of dependent origination, in one sense, shows the spiritual side of the evolution of an individual human being, starting with these subtle frames or attitudes of mind that look outwards, that then become aware of the senses. As you become aware of the senses and have contact with externals, you start either liking or disliking what you encounter. You either grasp after it or avoid it. And the cycle, one thing leads to another and comes around to what's called becoming, which is the moment of conception. Out of conception comes birth. Out of birth comes aging, illness, and death. When you die, and the body and mind, as we know it, drop away, the ignorance continues and links up, and the cycle goes around again. So I think of it as little things that snowball into bigger things, which then become you and me. We go through the cycle of our life. And remember, this is talking about the cycle of samsara without any clear understanding that you have a refuge anywhere. So it goes round and round and round. There is a longing there, but it's in kind of a holding pattern where you never really come back to center. It just goes around for as long as it takes. Now, another way of looking at this cycle, again, is this greed, hate, and delusion in the center of it. I like to think of delusion. Well, there are two things. One is that it's that little chattering squirrel up in the trees that says, if I could only get rid of greed and hate, I would be free. So it's looking in the wrong place for its peace of mind. The other thing is that delusion is that sort of blood and bones conviction that we're pretty much born into, that we're separate from the eternal. Because it is so much in our, just in our whole human being, as we meditate and begin to turn the stream of compassion within, not just our mind will change, but we'll find changes happening in our entire body. And part of being disturbed by the truth is that there can be a fair bit of physical discomfort that comes with the cleansing of karma. Now, the cleansing of karma shows effectively the grasping of the will that comes right at the heart of greed, hate, and delusion, where we come to what is described in the confession verse. All wrong actions, behavior, and karma perpetrated by me from time immemorial have been and are caused by greed, hate, and delusion, which have no beginning, born of my body, speech, and mind. I now make full and open confession thereof. So it's by accepting what we see in the mirror, whatever it, you know, whatever form it may take or whatever part of the cycle it may be, accepting it as it is, sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddha, and saying, help. That we learn how to convert this cycle and come to the still place, which isn't really illustrated other than just as an open center, which is the place of meditation at the heart of this mandala. When you make confession and accept responsibility for who and what you are, wherever, whatever the cause was in the past, whatever you may be, you can understand that the cosmic Buddha does not judge you and does not judge anyone. And when you come to that still center place, this whole panorama of the six worlds turns into the garden of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. And one way you can look at that garden is to look at the thousand-armed, thousand-eyed Bodhisattva here, which takes the form of a mandala. At the center, you will see that the Bodhisattva is make, with two of the hands is making gassho, is gathered, and with two of the hands is sitting in meditation holding a begging bowl. The begging bowl represents acceptance of things as they are, being still in the center. And then from that still center point, here, the Bodhisattva can extend his and her hands out to see where help is needed. You're looking for help within yourself, in your own life, and in those around you. With that central intent to train for the good of all living things, which is what the Kesa verse speaks of, which we recite every morning. So you still will find the koan arising even as you sit still in meditation. And what seemed like the world of suffering becomes the teaching that helps you to fully realize your true nature, which is not and never was separate from the life of the Buddha, which we all share together. One of the ways I like to think about the many arms and eyes of Avalokiteshvara is that with this still center there is much activity. And it's not just the activity of one person. So the thousand arms and the thousand eyes is the eyes of the training of the entire Sangha treasure, training together. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.